All right. Welcome back from your delicious lunch, wherever it was you went. I hope it was enjoyable and that you enjoyed your company. I had an excellent quesadilla from the vegetarian food truck here in town that is now taking Bitcoin. And so just a reminder for those of you that weren't here earlier today, we do have the Halloween costume dance party coming up tonight at 9 p.m. It's going to be right here in the hotel. And you will need to either have your pass with you or $10 to donate to freeross.org to get you in the door. And it should be a lot of fun. Derek J's putting it together. They'll be in here decorating a little bit later on. And so that's going to be a good time. So don't miss that tonight. I'm not sure if Cop Block is going to happen tonight. It did happen last night. I thought JP was going to be doing it tonight. He seems to think that maybe he won't be. So I'll let you know more about that as the day goes on. But that doesn't mean you couldn't go out there and do it on your own or recruit some of the keen locals to put one together sort of off the cuff. That's certainly possible. So still to come here tonight, James Cleveland will be doing the keynote speech later. You may know him as Robin Hood of Keene. Very excited to hear what he has to say. He was the activist of the year last year here in Keene. Also, the charity panel coming up for the very first time ever. Amanda Bolden and a number of her wonderful guests will be up here talking about various different charitable efforts from the Liberty community. So with no further ado, I want to introduce the head of the media panel this year. He was on the panel as a panelist last year and is now graduating to big boy seat. He's Mark Edge. He's my co-host on Free Talk Live. And we will be live tonight, by the way. So if you are in Keene, you can actually probably listen to us on the radio. Are the Red Sox in the World Series, or is that even happening? Baseball's over. So that means we're going to be on the radio tonight in Keene. It's Saturday, and you can actually listen to us over broadcast radio on WKBK on 1290 or 107.5. Mark and I, of course, will be live tonight, and Mark will introduce the remainder of this wonderful and experienced media panel.
Thanks so much. Like Ian said, I am Mark Edge. I host Free Talk Live with him. We've been doing it for about 12 years now. I'm going to participate as much as host the media panel because I want to be able to. My idea is, and I think we've been reasonably successful with this goal, is that we want more people to produce liberty-oriented media. New Hampshire is the mecca. It is the ground zero for the Liberty Media bomb. Certainly other shows are produced elsewhere. Some of them are awesome. Some of them are getting started. And there's nothing wrong with any of that. But New Hampshire, we've just got more per populace than any place in the world. And I think that has something to do with Free Talk Live coming here and Free Talk Live promoting the idea that, you know, you can reach more people this way, that when you make a podcast or you make a vodcast or whatever it is they call, you know, video shows that people do, whatever it is that you, whatever way you go about doing it, that media is an excellent way to spread the ideas of liberty. When somebody's consuming media, in most cases, they're on the receiving end of a message. And for whatever reason, that's powerful. If it was, you know, it was books at one point and still is books. Then it was movies and TV shows. And now we have podcasts and we have, video on demand and all these other things that are able to produce it. And I think that's powerful. And that's why I wanted to highlight different types of media on the panel and why I chose who I chose. So I've got Garrett Ian here. The name of his show is Aqua Keene Parking Force. If I got that right? Okay. AKPF number one. Okay. And I wanted to produce a lot of different things. What I've seen of AKPF number one, and I haven't, seen every episode, but it's strange. It's avant-garde. It's artsy. And that's going to appeal to an audience. And I thought it was important to have everything on the show or on the panel here. Dr. Stephanie Murphy is my co-host on Free Talk Live, and she has been in so many different things that it's hard to list them all off. Help me out if I miss something here.
Sure.
So Pork Therapy, and it's a couple of different iterations. The Sex and Science Hour, She's also a voiceover artist and is going to be apparently voicing, has voiced or is going to voice 101 Reasons.
Going to. It didn't make it in the premiere, okay. But it will be in the final cut.
What other movies have you done? Because I know I've heard your voice in a couple of videos.
I'm in the Bitcoin space. I host the podcast Let's Talk Bitcoin, and I've voiced just numerous short videos for Bitcoin companies. So short films about like Mycelium for BitPay. Okay. I've also done work for, you know, bigger brands like ABC Family and eBay and Dell and a couple other sort of national brands as a voice actor.
Yep. And as far as shows that you produce, it seems like there was one more that I was feeling like I needed
to mention. I'm the producer of Sovereign Tech, which is Brian Sovereign's podcast.
I didn't want to mention Sovereign Tech. That's it, right. And Brad has focused most of his efforts on the School Sucks project. And how many episodes you got? Close to 200? We're going to need a microphone for this.
Thank you. 340-ish, around there.
Excellent. And you would say that School Sucks, to some extent, was, Free Talk Live was influential in that, right?
Oh, absolutely. Very much so. Yeah, along with a couple other programs. But Free Talk Live was first.
Okay,
for sure.
And Chris Cantwell, you do a lot of different things, but your show is called Some Garbage Podcast.
Yes. Okay. Some Garbage Podcast, and I write pretty regularly on ChristopherCantwell.com.
And you've been contributed to what, Cop Block and... Where else are we here?
Cop Block, A Voice for Men, LouRockwell.com, Economic Policy Journal, The Dollar Vigilante, to name a few.
Okay, great. That's what I wanted to hear. So what we have here is a wide variety of folks that produce media here in New Hampshire. And I want you to consider, just for a second, what it might be like to try to put folks like this together someplace else in the country or in the world. You couldn't do it. I couldn't put a panel together like this anyplace else. New Hampshire's a tiny little clod of dirt that isn't very populated, but we've managed to have people, all movers, not one, we got one, two, local came back, local came back. Okay, so I've got two locals, two movers, and I'm always stunned to think how much is produced here and how much talent we have, because I believe the talent exists. I mean, we have a woman who's going here to be a medical doctor, research doctor, whatever you went did at New College. I'm not never sure what those guys are doing. A lot of consumption of marijuana. a teacher, and Chris, what did you install electronics equipment?
I was an IT guy and a security technician, and I have recently focused all my efforts on my creativity as a career.
Right, and that's actually going to be one of my questions here coming up, but what I'm trying to get across is that the talent exists. It's right out in the community, and all people need is an outlet, and they need a little push in the right direction. And here in New Hampshire, they've had that push, and I think it's very exciting. So that's my first question. I'm going to ask each one of you, do you make money off your podcast? And if you make money off your podcast, is it a living for you? So Cantwell, we'll start with you.
My podcast makes no money. I've spent a great deal of money on the equipment to produce it, and I haven't made a single, I wouldn't say I haven't made a single penny. I've made a couple of dollars off of AdSense revenues from the YouTube videos of the podcast. I do make some advertising revenue from the website, but my donations actually exceed the amount of revenue that I get through the website. If I was a little bit more effective as a salesman, I could probably make a little bit more advertising revenue, but most of it comes through AdSense, and I have a few people who pay me a little bit of money for for ad banners on the website. But I am able to eke out a meager living doing that right now, and if I focus on it, I'm convinced that I can make more, and that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, I suspect there are no millionaires sitting up here in front of you, but people that are able to produce part-time able to make enough money that you can focus on it and maybe hold another job. I think that that's what a lot of people should be aspiring to in their media. Brett?
Yes, I do. I tried to monetize the show and have it replace what I was doing for work about 2 years ago. I've been doing the show for over 5 years, and I remember when donations first started to come in, and I was surprised by that, and I was really encouraged by that. And as I started to rely on it more and more for income, it was kind of stressful to just sort of wait for random donations.
Yep.
So I set up subscription tiers. where people could, just based on their income, $6 a month, $9 a month, $12 a month, sign up to become a supporter of the show. And the idea was, because my show's marketed towards people who don't have money, like high school and college students, that they would kind of sponsor younger listeners. And people started to come into that. And when we built a new website in the beginning of 2013, I was able to really push, and from the beginning of 2013 to now, almost triple the amount of people who signed up for that by offering a bonus content section, which has like another 300 pieces of content that most people have never heard. So that's how I did it. I tried to give people an incentive, and I don't really do any advertising. I'm not opposed to it, but I've just never done that. It's never really fit with the format of the show. So the entire show is funded by listener contributions on a regular basis, so I can like predict it and know what I can expect week to week.
Stephanie?
Yeah, so I'm a full-time voice actor, and this is actually kind of new for me. I made a major career change about a year and a half ago. As Mark mentioned, I have a PhD in biochemistry, so what is a scientist doing? And I also went to med school for 2 years. So what is a scientist and a physician doing as a voice actor? Well, you know, quite simply, I wasn't happy in that career. It just wasn't a very free kind of thing, and it wasn't what I wanted for my life. So I made the transition to starting my own business, and I'm really glad I did it. But the reason I was able to go there was because I had started podcasting as a hobby, and that got me into the voiceover world, and people were saying, hey, you have a nice voice, you could do voice acting. And it's not quite that simple. I had to look into it and learn a lot, and I'm still learning, of course, but I was able to basically make a living using my voice. I've also made money from podcasts in the past. I had a subscription program with Pork Therapy, like Brett did. I also did sort of affiliate marketing a little bit for just, you know, Amazon links, and even had one for the Squatty Potty. That was a unique product for a while. Made a funny commercial about that. So, yeah, like if you get creative, you can monetize podcasts. It's probably not going to be a huge moneymaker. For me, it's mostly my voice work that pays the bills. But it's tied to doing podcasts, because when you put yourself out there as a podcaster, people get to know you and they want you in their projects. They want your voice in their projects.
Garrett?
The program I produce, the two general avenues of broadcast are the internet as well as local television here. Cheshire TV is cable access here. And anybody can submit anything they want to the local access show. And in fact, you're less likely to have it censored than if you tried YouTube or some other sites where there are conditions upon which your content will be removed. So using those avenues is a great way to free up what you're able to produce. As far as monetizing the content, I've never really monetized any media I've done. I feel a little strange asking for donations. And my primary avenues of income are activist-related, where I can collect lots of video, but aren't necessarily the production or release of like video or text, like articles that one might produce. It is important. It is important to be sustainable to make what you're doing. If you want to invest in something as like a regular television show or a regular podcast, you're going to reach a point where there's burnout if you're not getting a return. But fortunately, since you know involving other people in the project, I think is one way that keeps one motivated to continue producing what they're producing.
Garrett's art may not be understood in his lifetime. So Free Talk Live started in 2002, and we made, you know, here and there a little bit of money, but nothing that was ever going to, you know, sustain us for anything. And up until 2006, when we moved here for the Free State Project, we didn't make much. But then I had left my job as an advertising executive at a lifestyle magazine in Sarasota, Florida. And when we moved up, obviously, I wasn't going to continue doing that here. So I decided that I was going to do Free Talk Live full time. And we were on 27 stations at the time, and that seemed like enough. In retrospect, it was a terrible idea. But we did manage to make it work through essentially sponsors, and we have our amplifier program. So people who, you know, believe in what we do, they send us $3 or $5 a month. I can't remember what at the time, I think it was $3, and now it's up to $5. in order to support us. And then we had Jason Osborne of SACL CAI, who was giving a certain amount per month to keep us going as far as paychecks and that kind of thing. I cannot stress enough how important, if you believe in a media outlet as a voice of liberty, how important it is to sponsor that media outlet. Because for every 1,000 people that listen, one's going to give. That might be an exaggeration, but it's not too much of one. And so if you believe in these ideas, these, I think, are the best way to get the ideas out, short of a 10-term principled Republican congressman who's no longer going to be running for office. It's Liberty Media that has been spreading the word since then. And people get into it because they're passionate about it. But as Garrett said, they're not going to keep doing it if they can't, make something out of it. People's interests change, and money interests people. That's the reality of it. So it keeps folks going. How did you learn how to do your particular type of content production? So, obviously anybody can go to WordPress and get a blog. I'd probably have to figure out how to do that myself. But there's things when it comes into the production of podcasts and video, and you have to know how to use certain equipment and programs in order to, compress it and make it work and stick it on the internet somehow so people can use it. And of course, your website has to be usable so that people can get to it. How did you manage to do that, Garrett?
I grew up tinkering with video cameras, and at the time, I remember when I was really small, how they were very expensive, and it seemed like a very rare opportunity to get to use one. And then, as I grew, of course, it's gotten to a point where everyone has a camera. It's so easy to just film something, create something quickly. You learn how to create more quality media, create a more finished product by just tinkering with the editing software yourself. I remember starting with whatever's native to Windows software, like Windows Movie Maker, and the first few activism videos I made on that, and just adding text and learning how to do cuts and stuff. It's very much a trial and error process. You need to make a lot of content that you don't really like to learn from it and make something better. You're going to learn you want to get better audio with a better mic or a better camera, etc. For me, I feel like it's important to already having the tools was something that when I decided to make a show to take a slot at Cheshire TV, I already had the tools to create the product. I just needed to physically invest the time and energy each week to making sure that you collect 30 minutes worth of content or you produce 30 minutes worth of content. I just recommend using what's available. Like cell phones, I'd say probably don't cut it yet, as far as the quality you're going to produce. But if you spend $200 on a camera, you can get something that's going to create a high enough quality image for someone's consumption. It'll be Yeah, I guess that's about it.
So I was pretty much all self-taught, but with some really important help. And the great thing about now, this period in history, is that the barriers to entry for being the media and creating your own media are just getting so low that pretty much anyone can do it. The cost of sound equipment, especially, and video equipment is going down. There's free software available, like Audacity, which is a free digital audio workstation that's professional quality that you can use to produce sound, podcasts, and I use it in my voice work all the time. So really, anyone can do it if they're motivated to learn, but there definitely are things you need to learn. So I have to actually credit Ian a lot, Ian Freeman, who has organized Keenvention, with helping me figure out a lot of this stuff. I was on Free Talk Live a long time ago, and that was how I learned to be a live radio host. But also, I remember one of the first podcasts that I did with Mike Barsky on Pork Therapy, who I started the show with. I remember getting an email from Ian and saying, guys, it sounds like there's something in the background, a refrigerator, an air conditioner, some horrible fan noise. And then we kind of listened back to our show and we said, oh yeah, he's right. The sound quality is really awful. So what can we do to improve that? So we did take that advice and we, continued learning little tricks to optimize the sound. Pretty soon I had built my own studio in a spare room in my house for, $500, $800. It wasn't too much. It was totally doable and it had really professional sound and people were commenting on how professional the sound quality of my podcast was. So you can go from having a crappy fan in the background to having a total studio sound in your home if you want to, quite easily.
Let me add to the question real quick. Did you have was there a practice period before you started producing content that you released?
Ah, that's a good question. No, we put out our most embarrassing stuff from day one. And that's okay, because everybody's podcast is embarrassing in the beginning. And you're going to look back on it in a couple years and you're going to say, oh my God, I can't believe I let that out there. But it's part of the learning process, because you have to get feedback from the people who are hearing it. There's a lot of free tools available for you. Learn Audacity. That's like the first step. I think that's the free audio software that I use a lot in my work. I actually am right now working on a couple of courses for Udemy about how to produce an audiobook with Audacity from a home studio, and how to learn Audacity for podcasting. So maybe by the time the video of this hits YouTube, those might be available. But the point is, you can learn it yourself. It may take some effort. It may be a little faster if you have like a course for someone to teach you all the shortcuts, but it's totally doable for anybody.
And I'm not trying to get cute with my answer here, but at some point in 2011, I sent Stephanie an email and said, your show sounds really good. What are you doing? And she sent me a spreadsheet of everything she had, and I went out and bought it. And I came to her house one night and took pictures of her settings, and then, you know, took the mixer home, played with it. And this was after, gosh, maybe like a year and a half of doing the show with trial and error. And I thought in the beginning, I mean, the standards were lower in 2009. And I thought, you know, if you could record your voice into an MP3 file and have it show up on the internet, you were a podcaster. And I think there was also a feedback loop that was really important for me. People would send me emails and say, your show sounds awful. You know, it's a shame, because it sounds like you have good things to say, but it's almost unlistenable. And also getting feedback from other podcasters. Stefan Molyneux sent me a mic after I'd done like 20 episodes, the one that he used to do in his car. He sent that to me, and I used that. And then I connected with these other guys in Connecticut. They're like, here's what we're using. And I upgraded to like a Samson USB mic. And then when Stephanie did her upgrade for her home studio shortly after that, I went out and bought the same stuff. I've upgraded the mics since then, but I'm still using the same mixer. I still have the same mixer, and a couple of those mics I still use.
What about practice shows? Did you?
No. Well, one of the most helpful things for me was I actually connected with Wes Bertrand like in the end of 2008. So like almost 9 or 10 months before I started School Sucks.
And ladies and gentlemen, Wes Bertrand.
Oh, there he is in the back. He's actually here. So I was a real big fan of his show, and his book was a really important book, Complete Liberty.
Complete Liberty, available on Amazon.
I wrote to him, and I think I asked him, like, can I audition to be on your show? And I gave him, like, a little bit of my history. He's like, you could just come on the show, and we'll, you know, I think we planned to do an hour, and we wound up doing, like, 6 hours of shows about education. And then he invited me back to do a series about something else, like, the next summer, the summer of 2009. And I was like really eager to do more, and I realized I had had all this stuff accumulating about my own experience from the 10 prior years that I had spent working in school. So we probably had, I don't know, 10 to 15 episodes of his show in the can before I did any episodes of School Sucks podcast.
That's kind of practice.
Yeah. But it would have been good to, like, on my own equipment. I would recommend that to people who want to start. Maybe do 3 secret shows that you could release later as, like, bonus content.
Bonus content that people are willing to pay for.
If you can get over your embarrassment. But people will love it even if you hate it. So
you can do it as a gift, or in exchange for, like, hey, sign up for my email list and you can hear the 3 crappiest shows I ever did. But if you make it, if you're successful, people might like to hear that. I would like to hear episodes of Free Talk Live from 2002, you know, which I've never heard.
So find them somewhere. The reason I chuckled, by the way, about Stephanie's this comment about the Stephanie spreadsheet is because this is one of the most organized people I have ever met. When something, you know, when you're talking about important information with you, she'll take notes and she writes them down and keeps them. It's just amazing. It saves work. I just haven't learned the lesson in my life. Cantwell?
I would say failure and competition. And self-hatred would have been my my primary motivations for improving matters. I mean, I do a bunch of different types of content, right? So, I mean, I film activist video. I think probably the way people started recognizing me was for doing, like, YouTube rants. And if you see some of my earlier rants, at first you can see me, my head is going back and forth as I'm reading the text on my screen. It was just embarrassing, and people were pointing it out in the YouTube comments. And then I thought it'd be real bright to just, like, wear sunglasses when I did it. And then people were talking about the sunglasses. And, like, it was just ridiculous. And eventually I got a tablet that, you know, and then I got a teleprompter app, you know, just... You know, people trying to improve it over time. Most of the content that I produce is text. I'm writing is the vast majority of what I'm doing. So that, I mean, I realized I had a talent for writing many years ago. I was just like a club promoter, you know, and I was out drinking and shit like this, and I wrote a thing called Diaries of a Dipsomaniac on MySpace. And it was actually, like, pretty popular, you know, just me coming home blacked out drunk and writing what happened before I forgot about it. And people were really into it, right? And then, like, I deleted all of this when I ran for Congress because I was like, Jesus Christ, people can't find this shit. And so that's all gone now, never to be found again. And then just, you know, September of last year, right before I got expelled from the Free State Project, I decided to start writing again. And surprisingly enough, to me at least, it turned out to be very popular. And I'm never happy with anything that I put out. Everything I put out, I'm like, oh, I should edit this, I should edit it. I got to get the fucking content out. And you put it out, and you take your negative comments, and you take your lumps, and you try to improve it next time. The podcast, we started doing this with me and my business partner in New York, and the first episode, like, our mics weren't even picking up. It was the cameras across the room, and there's echoes, and it sucks. And then I buy a mixer, and I'm like, I'm not happy with this mixer. I buy another mixer. I buy, you know, so failure and wasting money and trying to save money and then saying that was a waste of money, trying to save it, just, you know, correcting your mistakes over the course of period of time is, I think, how content improves over time, and that's been my experience.
Before this is panel's over, I'm going to kick Cantwell off the stage, just so you know. You're getting kicked out of every place. So,
I don't want to be a member of any club that would have me as a member anyway.
So once you've gotten, you know, going and you're producing content, the next thing is to get listeners. Obviously, you have to have something listenable at first, and then, or, you know, readable, and whatever the situation, watchable. And then it's to get listeners. So what do you do for marketing for your show? And, you know, how do you go about getting listeners? Stephanie?
Okay, you picked the worst person to ask first.
I'm going to ask them all.
But I'll let you in on a little secret. I was talking to someone the other day, and he said, oh, you can market this to your email list. And I said, well, I don't have an email list. And he went, what? And, yeah, I've never had an email list. I hate social media. I haven't posted anything on Facebook in months. I don't really tweet very much. I don't like promoting stuff.
And yet the Sex and Science Hour had more than 6,000 downloads per episode, which is probably about...
Because of the name.
Well, that... Okay, having sex...
And naming your show is extraordinarily important.
Having sex in the name of your podcast is a good way to get people to listen to it, so perhaps that had some influence, but... The most popular show that I'm on is Let's Talk Bitcoin, and it's a podcast about Bitcoin. It comes out twice a week. We've been doing it for about a year and a half with my co-hosts Andreas Antonopoulos and Adam B. Levine. And I basically just show up and talk for that podcast. I don't really do much of the promotional work, but something's working because we get, you know, 10, 20,000 downloads on every show. And I think it's really just because there's people want to hear about Bitcoin. And especially when the show started, we were filling a niche that no one else was filling. And so we got a lot of followers. And, you know, some of them drop off, but new ones come on and they want to learn about Bitcoin. So I guess the biggest thing that I could say to get listeners is just do a show that people want to hear. That's really the main thing. It doesn't matter how much you tweet about it or whatever. If you aren't doing content that people want.
Brett?
I think it's obviously really important to have a niche, you know? Like, that way you know the kind of people that you're attracting, or at least it's a couple different types of categories, young people, college students for me, homeschooling parents is a big portion of my audience. So then you kind of, you're able to put together a message that goes to those groups. And I find that I'm doing shows in a rotation, like, oh, the people who are interested in home education will like this, or this is a good thing for high school students to hear. And even people who aren't in high school say, oh, that's good, he's doing something for high school students, because that's who the show is supposed to be for. But the best marketing that I've ever done is just to get on bigger shows, shows with bigger audiences, and try to do a good job.
As an interview?
Yeah, as an interview. And a lot of the time that was just luck, you know, coming across the right people or having them come across me. I did a really big show last week that I'm excited about called Red Ice Radio. They're like out of Scandinavia somewhere. So I'm excited to see how that turns out. It's been a while since we've had a significant bump, but you know, I don't mind preaching to the choir so much because I think they are there for a reason, right? And they're staying there for a reason. So having a niche has always been really important. I didn't want just like a generalized Liberty show. I mean, that could certainly work for some people with some personalities, but it wasn't what my show is. So, and again, maybe I'm the second worst person to ask about marketing. We don't do too much of it. One thing that I did do that's like a small practical tip is I find people who post a lot on Facebook, a lot of pictures. Those are really popular. Like if you spend 15 hours on like some kind of audio project and you say, hey, everyone, look, and it gets 2 likes on Facebook, but then you grab something off Imgur and it takes 10 seconds and you throw it up and it gets 150 likes. It's frustrating, but people do that. So I found people who are just posting, you know, pictures, memes all day, and I make them admins. If I trust them and I know them, I make them admins on the fan pages. And one guy got us like 500 additional likes just from doing it 4 or 5 times a day in a month. So, I mean, it's obligatory for me to use Facebook and Twitter. I don't enjoy it much either, but it's been part of growing the show for sure.
When you say using Facebook and Twitter, what you mean is marketing in the way that those media outlets, sort of the people that consume those media outlets want to have it. Because audio, I have found, is just lays there like a dead rat on Facebook. I mean,
yeah.
We, you know, Free Talk Live, one of the, you know, the 5-time award-winning best political podcast in the world, can't get 500 post views on a piece of audio that we put up on a page that has 40,000 likes on it. So,
right, yeah.
I mean, it just goes nowhere.
I started attaching pictures or memes to the link to the audio file. It seems like Facebook, what they're doing now is if they know it's coming from the site associated with the fan page, they're like tamping down its exposure.
Yeah, Facebook doesn't want the rest of the internet to be seen, sadly.
Right.
Cantwell, marketing the show.
So I think social media is a huge part of it. You're correct about Facebook's algorithms. They will intentionally push down the website associated with a particular page. They want you to buy advertisements, right? They've been slowly dampening your posts more and more if you're a brand page. I'm lucky in the sense that before I ever started producing media, I had a really big social networking presence. I reached 5,000 Facebook friends while I was running for Congress, and you know, Twitter and Google Plus. I got into Google Plus before it was even public, so I have a following on Google Plus that exceeds 30,000 people. Getting into new things, I think, is especially important. You get in at the ground level of something like Google Plus, and then you have a huge following when other people are like, what the fuck is even it? This is a thing. So social media is huge. If you understand how Facebook's algorithms work, you can use it. They were talking about like posting an image instead of a link to your instead of a link to your thing. Images have a tendency of going viral on Facebook. So if you have an interesting image that has a link to your content in the description, then certainly you're going to drive more traffic to it. Ultimately, I think you have to have some way of building up an initial following. But once you have the initial following, if your content's interesting, it'll get around. I know the difference between good content that I produce and crap content that I produce because I could put up 2 articles in a day and one of them will go crazy viral and the other one will sit there and do nothing.
What's the difference?
What's the difference?
Yeah, how do you know? I mean, what do you look for in it? What could you see there?
I would say that would be difficult to describe. I mean, I know that when I write something good, I guess it's like the Supreme Court's definition of pornography, right? Like, I don't know how to describe it, but I know it when I see it, you know. And so I mean, if there's passion, if it's an interesting story, if it's a compelling read, then people are going to be far more apt to share it, whether they agree with the point or not. They're
what about controversy? That seems to be really something that you'd do
well. That was the next part that I was going to get. Hate is the best part of my life. So, there are so many people who just try to destroy me, and they are just totally fucking themselves over because
you can't beat somebody below ground level.
The more people talk shit about me, the more people read my stuff. And if I could have a dollar for every email I got of, hey, I checked you out because so-and-so was talking shit and turns out you're awesome, you know, I mean, it would far exceed my advertising revenues. But that's another part of it. And I think that there's a good aspect to that for a lot of people, right? If you take a jab at another popular show, you know, you're driving attention to that show. You're creating an argument with another libertarian. And if you look at like the political landscape, I mean, the way that our televisions would like us to believe politics works is that, you know, hey, is it the Republican or the Democrat? Do you want to be a conservative or a liberal? Well, they're very good at limiting the scope of the discussion. So I say, you know, let libertarians argue with each other and let that be the frame of discussion, because if they decide that one libertarian is wrong, then they conclude that the other libertarian is right, and I can't think of a better outcome than that. A lot of people, you know, hate that. They think that I'm just stirring up drama and trying to divide the movement. No, I'm trying to spark intellectual conversation, and some people take it personally and fuck them. But so yeah, I would say that definitely like drama, controversy, infighting, these things all help drive attention to both people. A great example I'll give you is even like Kathy Reisenwitz. I can't stand the woman, right? And so I pick on her. But at the same time, like, I'm not a big fan of feminism, but if they're going to learn about feminism, I prefer they learn about it from Kathy Reisenwitz, who says, hey, here's all these ridiculous ideas, don't use the state to enforce them, than somebody who goes and learns about feminism from somebody who's going to tell them that they need to pass a law. So if I'm fighting with Kathy Reisenwitz, well, I might be decreasing her credibility in libertarian circles, but I doubt a vulgar MRA attacking her diminishes her credibility in feminist circles, you know? So, you know, Kathy didn't do much the favor of linking back to me, and I stopped bothering her after a while, but, you know, Antonio Bueller sure as fuck did, and thank him for that. I should send that guy a check.
So, God damn. In radio, we call this stunting. How do you look for your, apparently, the targets of your vitriol? How do you find these people?
When I am, you know, consuming media, if I get a lot of my news from social media, so Facebook, Twitter, that sort of thing. If I see that something is going around, if other people are critical of it or highly praising it, then I will look for something to attack inside of it. You know, so you know, sometimes it's very clear cut things. I just released a piece about Stefan Molyneux's lawsuit.
The truth about Stefan Molyneux?
It's not the truth about Stefan Molyneux, but it's truthful to the best of my knowledge. It's not the title of it, but so you know, the situation, he made some DMCA complaints to YouTube to get this other user taken down, and I felt like a lot of people had sort of attacked everything that Molyneux had ever done. And I'm like, well, no, actually, you know, a lot of the stuff Molyneux has done is good, and I think that this is a transgression that he needs to confess to and make restitution for. And of course, you know, anybody attacks Molyneux, all Molyneux's fans want to read it, and anybody, you know, who's interested in me is interested to hear what I have to say about it. If Molyneux would fucking respond to me one of these fucking days, it would certainly help me out a whole lot and create an interesting discussion. So yeah, I think that definitely conflict and infighting helps further discussion and drive traffic and make money.
Garrett, how do you market AKPF?
The one form of marketing that is unavoidable is the packaging of your product itself. What title are you going to give it? What quick description are you going to give it? So there's always the temptation to have a juicier headline than maybe the video you've produced, or you know, there's always that that sort of temptation to, you know, get what's called clickbait, I guess, on social media. I try and avoid that, and, you know, be somewhat either completely straightforward or completely ambiguous. The marketing I employ I don't employ any other traditional marketing. I don't buy YouTube, Facebook ads. I often will forget to post links to the shows when I finish them, but every week they'll still appear on the YouTube page regardless. Since it's a more locally driven or locally focused program that I produce, I'm often at downtown chalking different activist-related things, and I'll often chalk AKPF number one. People have gotten used to seeing it everywhere. As it's a reference to the parking enforcement in Keene, people that are keeping up with the Robin Hood case and the news on that sort of activity, you know, they can link the two, of course, since they are pretty closely linked. And yeah, I'd say controversy definitely does drive attention to something. The local newspaper, the Keene Sentinel, wrote an editorial in which they critiqued the show a few episodes in because they thought that we were concealing the bad stuff that I guess they were associating Free Keene and the Robin Hooders with, and saying that the show was just the lighthearted stuff and it's meant to fool you. So yeah, as Cantwell said, like controversy and someone who's critical of your program is what's going to draw attention to it. I'd say even more than praise.
So Aqua Keene Parking Force is, I mean, it's not just art, it's ironic in some ways. I mean, how would you describe the comedy that's associated with it?
I'd say it's a parody of a lot of what's going on. I'll often take like either news clips or voice samples or anything that you can edit over. You know, you can stick people's faces on different characters from programs and sort of create a strange reality in that way. But yeah, I wouldn't really say there's like one way of summing it up. I'd say it's like a sort of surreal parody of what's actually going on with, you know, the bureaucrats in town or the activists and the city employees.
Yeah, reality wasn't what I was thinking of when I see Aqua Keene Parking Force now. Brett, do you go for a general audience or a specific audience?
Specific. Okay. So, I mean, originally, when we started the show, I mean, the reason why I called the show School Sucks is I really wanted to focus on like 15 to 21, you know, high school, early college, and have the show be a resource for them. And the idea was, because I was an anarchist and I thought these ideas were really important and I was really passionate about them at the time, you know, getting kids into thinking about some of that stuff through this issue on which we already agree, the sucking of school, I thought that was good marketing. But from there, you know, just connecting with other podcasters and, you know, taking on some of their audience, by, you know, the end of the first year of the show, we had a lot of people who were coming from your audience to listen to us. So then I felt like it was in some ways becoming more of what I didn't want, like a general libertarian kind of show. So I had to play to that a little bit more than I wanted to. And then, like, homeschooling people started to write to me. So like I said before, I'm just trying to rotate for these interest groups that I think we have in our audience on a consistent basis, which are high school students, college students, voluntarists, libertarians, anarchists, or home education parents.
Do you feel limited by the name School Sucks Project?
Yeah. I mean, and so sometimes like it's made it harder to get serious guests, you know? I can't think of anyone offhand, but there's a lot of Alfie Cohen, somebody that I went after and never heard back from. And I think that the libertarianness of the show turns some people off. I mean, there's a lot of people who do really good work as far as the advocacy of young people in school, like Alfie Cohen, Mike Mayles, Bruce Levine, but they're all lefties. And you know, I managed to get a couple of these people, but I think there's a lot of people who I've lost because of the name, or haven't been able to access because of the name. But you know, on the other hand, too, I think a lot of the listeners came because of the name.
Yeah, it's the two-edged sword.
Sucks is like the second best word after sex that you can have in the title of the show. Sucking, you know.
Cantwell, is it a general audience or a specific audience?
I'm kind of still figuring that out, if I'm honest with you. I mean, when I started making YouTube videos for kicks, you know, I didn't even really expect anybody to watch them, and they got more traffic than I expected. And, you know, when I started writing, it was more of just an outlet for myself. I was really surprised that people were actually reading what I had to say. I was shocked at how popular it was, and that continues to grow more popular, and I continue to be more and more shocked by it. But I have recently tried to attract a broader audience. I'm addressing more subjects. You know, I was originally mostly writing very, you know, fiery, political, philosophical stuff. I started addressing, like, fitness and shit recently, you know, and different things within the movement, right? So I wrote an article called Fitness Advice from a Fat Alcoholic, and I was shocked, you know, as thousands of people are reading this thing of just, it's in the picture that it entices you to come is just fat ass me pushing out my stomach with no shirt on. And I'm like, oh my God, people are actually clicking on this. What the fuck? And so, you know, I guess I'm trying to reach a broader audience, because then if people, you know, if people click on something because they're interested in nootropic drugs, or if they're interested in, you know, a particular news story, if they're interested in fitness subjects, whatever it is, then I can bring them in and hear them talk, get them to listen to me talk about these things from an anarcho-capitalist perspective, and, you know, hopefully get them to subscribe to the email list or on social media where they'll see other things. So initially, I wasn't really looking for an audience. I was just doing shit for fun, and it just so happened that I got a pretty big audience, and now I'm really interested in growing it, so I'm trying to go more general.
Garrett, specific or general?
I would say when I first started producing more activist-type videos of either police misbehaving or bureaucrats misbehaving, that I had more of a general audience in mind, just to show everybody what's going on here, who the good guys are, who the bad guys are. You know, I guess you could say that's propaganda, but, you know, it's open and open about its bias. As I've produced the show for Cheshire TV, I'd say that I've begun to think more of a specific audience in mind, and that's the audience that I'd say is the most reactive to what I've produced, and I'd say that's generally an older population, you know, the people that are actually watching local access television. It's probably not a younger audience, and I've kept that in mind with the with like the amount of, I'd say, somewhat controversy the show's created, like people saying it's misleading or it's, you know, it's just, it's not right or, you know, whatever. It's not really offensive content that I produce as far as, like, you know, foul language or, you know, violence. But, yeah, thinking about the fact that people are following, there's, as many people here probably know, there's a very strange reactionary group called Stop Freaking that follows what goes on in liberty activist circles and tries to expose it. And the fact that so many people, either from that group or, you know, older people just watching TV, have taken such an offense to something they see as new or different, it's something that I want to try and, like, you know, cultivate or push a little bit further and make them more, like, make them step outside of their comfort zones, because, you know, they're not changing the channel to watch other things that may be more out there on other channels. That I think there's some sort of, like, cherishing of the local stuff that's being produced that people have, and they don't want to see it going in a different direction or a certain direction that they don't consider traditional.
Stephanie, general, specific?
It's so hard when you're starting a podcast to think of a great name for it that's going to fit the whole way through, because podcasts and shows just change and evolve. And I think I have what I think is a really interesting case study in branding. So I started out podcasting, and my show was called Pork Therapy. Pork like a porcupine, therapy like talk therapy or emotional stuff. And the idea was, like, me and my friend Mike, who I started the podcast with, were kind of just sitting there one day, and we were like, oh, you know, we should do some kind of advice show, like a relationship advice show, but not from a status perspective, from a liberty-loving perspective. And so that was how we came up with the name, Pork Therapy. And it went on for several years, and I promoted the show and did it, and it got, you know, it got downloads. It got maybe 1,000 downloads, but it wasn't like that. It wasn't super popular, right? So I had a core audience, but it never really reached beyond a certain level. And that name is very, like, insider. It's very, you hear pork and you're like, okay, Free State Project. Forbes actually wrote an article about all these businesses that had the name pork in it, and it mentioned pork therapy, which was really funny. It was like, you know, the porcupine realtor.
Did you get a bump from that?
A little bump, I guess, but I mean,
people just interested by the name then.
Yeah, but people, I mean, I don't think they stuck around because they hear that, and it had liberty branding all over it. You know, it had like a little porcupine sitting on a couch with a voluntarist V, and it was like, they could probably say to someone who's not familiar with that stuff, hey, this isn't for you, this is for the in crowd. So I think that was one reason why it didn't get as popular as the next show that I did, which was Sex and Science Hour. Okay, so Sex and Science Hour was the name of a segment on Pork Therapy, actually, where I talked about sex and science. And it was very much not a, like, let's change the world kind of show. It wasn't like we're going to win hearts and minds and bring people over to liberty, like I think a lot of people start out podcasts thinking maybe. It was just, I'm going to talk about the things that I think are interesting and entertaining and just do an entertaining podcast and maybe people will tune in. And that show immediately became incredibly popular and it got thousands more downloads than Pork Therapy ever did. It was also picked up by the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network, which is a podcast network kind of like LRN. And it was the only show on that network that really wasn't much about Bitcoin. I mean, we would talk about Bitcoin sometimes on Sex and Science Hour, but it wasn't the main focus. It was mostly sex and science stories and discussion about them. And it was a fun show. And it got way more popular. And I think one of the reasons, as much as I hate to say this or admit it, is that it wasn't explicitly like Liberty branded. We kind of snuck it in. It's like, you know those recipe books where they tell you how to like put spinach in your kids' brownies and things like that? It was like that. Like the Liberty was subtle, but it was totally there. And I think people were more willing to give it a chance and listen because of that, because they didn't see the branding and think, oh, well, this isn't for me. I'm not even going to press play.
The term jump the shark and, you know, like the ideas when you see TV shows, they, you know that this series should have come to an end at some point and it didn't. Do you have an end game for your show or is it just you're going to produce it until, you know, maybe people stop or whatever? What's your thought?
You know, the show, Some Garbage Podcast, again, it's a thing. I've got 15 episodes of it out. I'd like to do some more. There's not much of a plan. We're generally talking about, whoever's on the show with me will start talking about whatever's in the headlines that day, and then we'll get off into whatever lunatic shit we end up talking about, you know? So I don't know that there's any need for an end to something like that. When we talk about shows jumping the shark, we're generally talking about fiction shows, that there's a storyline and for whatever reason it's making money so they try to continue the story. You know, as opposed to things like, I don't know, I was very disappointed when, say, The Sopranos ended, where I felt like this could have gone on, or Californication could have gone on. Whereas, you know, some other shows, 24, for example, probably could have gotten done a little sooner.
Firefly.
But I think if you're just talking about current events and people and stuff like that, I'm not sure that there's any reason for a show to come to an end. It's something that there's an endless amount of conversation to be had as the world changes and different things are happening and different people are rotating it out with different ideas. I'm not sure that a show of that nature can jump the shark unless the people who are doing it just cease to be entertaining. And, you know, who knows? Maybe that'll happen at some point, but I don't foresee it.
Garrett?
The content I produce is so open-ended and could go in any different direction each week that I don't think there really is an end to it. I don't plan on ending it anytime soon. And I like the kind of free-form nature of, like, anybody could contribute or, you know, give me content to broadcast. So in that sense, I guess in the general sense of like an end game for one's media, I'd say that if you do have a specific goal for your media and you're trying to achieve that goal, that would be a good, you know, end game. With local media as opposed to like, I think many people who create liberty-oriented media are just doing so with the general idea of spreading, you know, ideas of liberty, with getting more people to agree with certain aspects of that culture. But I'd say, like, in a larger sense, if you're creating a piece of media that the idea is, like, you know, in a fixed point in time, like, this thing is important. How important it's going to be, I guess, depends on, you know, how important, you know, people consider it or how important those ideas either become or like, are moved away from. I don't plan on ending AKPF1 anytime soon, but, you know, the possibilities are endless.
Stephanie, you've ended more shows than the rest of us here have projects. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I guess I very much went through a shift that I alluded to a little earlier, which is like when I started out podcasting, especially doing Pork Therapy, it was very much like, let's change the world, right? Let's help other people with their relationship issues. Let's spread the message of liberty. It was very like outwardly focused. But what I realized over time is that I can't really control any of that. And it just kind of makes you miserable when you focus on trying to change things that you have no control over. Instead of focusing on other people's problems, I should really focus on my own problems and my own self, including, you know, making this big career change in my life. And starting, you know, having a business like a podcast is part of what makes me happy and what helps me pay the bills. And so focusing on that, I thought, you know, over time I started to think that was probably more important than trying to kind of save the world. So I guess there doesn't have to be an end game to a podcast if there's no real goal in the first place. If it's just an entertaining show, it could go on forever. But do you want it to go on forever? Do you want to do a show that doesn't really have a specific goal, or do you want to do a show that does have a concrete goal? Or do you want to do a show that has a goal that you can actually attain? You know, if your goal is to read a book into audiobook format, that has a specific concrete end. So you could do a podcast that has 12 episodes, one for each chapter, for instance. Or if you want to do a podcast that teaches people how to use Audacity, well, you've taught a bunch of lessons and there you go, you're done with your podcast. But if you're doing a podcast that aims to end the wars or get everyone to use Bitcoin or like try to, you know, turn everyone into a libertarian, it's never going to end because you're never going to get that. So should you even try to get that? And the conclusion that I came to was, not really. I don't think I'm going to try to do that anymore. So right now, the projects that I'm working on don't really have much of an end game because there is no like specific concrete goal that they're trying to accomplish. It's more just, we're going to podcast for fun and profit.
Brett, School Sucks has really been several different podcasts strung together. It's like first you started with the, you know, focusing on school, and then you more into the liberty stuff, and you've done it over time. What do you think? What is there? You know, do you want an end game, or are you going to continue to evolve and go on your passions?
I think anything that fits into the category of alternative education, I mean, I'll do a show about. So I think on that we could go on forever. And you know, we mentioned like preaching to the choir before, and I get emails from people, and they say things like, "Hey, could you do more shows about school sucking?" Mm-hmm. And I'm like, "Really? Why? You know, like we did that." I mean, I feel right. Like, yeah, the show went through a bunch of phases, and in the beginning, it was almost like therapy for me because it was like the first, I don't know, like 20 to 50 shows were basically reenactments of these fantasies I had about how political and philosophical and educational arguments should have gone, you know, that I had in my life previous to that, and I was just like reenacting them without the other person there annoying me, you know, like this would have been perfect. And so it was very angry, it was very lively, but once more money started to come in and I realized that the show could be a career, it was a question of how can I add value, right? If we're always talking about alternative education, what am I doing, right? And some shows, I guess, don't need that, but I felt like my show did. So we started doing series on critical thinking, logical fallacies, self-esteem, better communication, fitness, nutrition, all that. I'm forgetting history. We did a lot of history series. I don't think that we could ever run out of content. And if people want to hear stuff about school, they can go back to the first, you know, 40 or 50 episodes. I mean, we revisit it. Schools are still making news for us, so we do revisit those things. But that's not really what the show's about anymore.
Yeah, Free Talk Live is a radio program primarily and then a podcast secondarily. By the way, I'm going to start taking questions here, so if people have them, begin to line up. And one of the things that we have to kind of keep in mind with radio is you have to constantly be resetting. You have to constantly do the things that you've done in the past. And whereas with podcasts, you can kind of do as Brett was talking about here, you can encyclopedize the things that you wanted to talk about. You can go back, you can you know, spruce them up, and you can, what I think is really important is in your newest shows, you can talk about the older episodes, which, you know, volumes people can go to refer to, what it is that they may want to hear, the specifics they may want to hear. And this is really important because people are coming in all the time to your media, and you need to, you know, you need to let them know. You need to give them some directions. When you've, you know, everybody's been in the situation where they're at, you know, Walmart or Kmart or Target or whatever, asking where the bathroom is, and there's a big giant sign on the wall you didn't see. People need help with directions, and so that's what you need to constantly be giving them as a media provider. Ms. Rumpler, God, good
Lord. I'm so short. I have to take it down. All right. So I was wondering if you guys could give us other podcasters and video people some advice on what software to use, especially you, Garrett, who does video editing, but I do video and podcasting, so both really help. So what programs do you guys use?
I am lacking in skills in the audio editing arena. I've used Audacity briefly, but that is something I could work with. But video, I've always used either free or open source technology. Right now, since I run Ubuntu on my computer, I have OpenShot Video Editor is an open source, free, pretty basic video editor. There's some things it can't do. And to make up for some things that like that freer technology can't do, I'd say that get to know a few different basic types of video editing softwares, because one thing you may want to do with one it can't do, you can do with another and get the same end result. The simpler the better. There's very, very complicated, very expensive video editing software. Premiere is a popular one. Vegas is a popular one. And you can do a little bit more with those. You can be a little more precise with those, but there is much more of a... Those you would pay for.
Microphone, so it's recorded.
Right.
I mean, just asking if they were free or paid.
Sure, you can torrent some of these, but you're supposed to pay if you want the fully functioning version. But unless you really need to make the highest quality product, I'd say that go with the free stuff. It gets the job done in a pretty simple and easy way.
Does anybody have anything else that they want to chime in on? Yeah. Stephanie?
For audio, Audacity all the way. It's free. It runs on Windows, Mac, and Linux, and it does everything Adobe Audition or Twisted Wave or any of those other ones do.
But does it produce MP3s?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah,
all it was producing for me was these .aud files or something.
Oh, you need an encoder to export the MP3, but it's available. The problem is, this is why I'm making this Udemy course on Audacity, is because there are no good tutorials about how to use Audacity, especially about how to use it for specific purposes like producing a podcast. So I'll get that out as soon as I possibly can.
I'll go ahead and co-sign Audacity. That's how, when I do the podcast, the audio portion of that is recorded with Audacity. And it's got everything built into it. I mean, you've got noise reduction, that sort of thing. The only thing you do need is the lame MP3 encoder. And I'm not making fun of the MP3 encoder. That's what it's called, LAME. And instead of saving it, you would export it. And I'm looking forward to Stephanie's production on how to do it, because it did take it. There is a little bit of a learning curve getting used to it. But for audio, I'd absolutely endorse Audacity. I have no regard for intellectual property whatsoever, so I torrent everything. I have a cracked version of Windows. I have a cracked version of Sony Vegas, and I use Sony Vegas for all of my video editing. I used to use a program for my video editing. I used to use a program called CyberLink PowerDirector. It's very, very, very easy to use. And if you're just getting started, you might want to check out CyberLink PowerDirector. But Sony Vegas, I've found, is easy enough to use and has a lot more advanced features.
I would say what's also important if you're looking for quality output is the quality of your inputs. So I would second what pretty much everyone has said. I've used Audacity for every episode of my podcast. I use Sony Vegas Pro 10. I obtained it for free. I think maybe, somebody else made Vegas before Sony bought that technology and it was more expensive. I think you can buy the full version for $100. You can certainly find it for a lot less. My version works perfectly. I found Sony Vegas to be probably one of the most user-friendly and intuitive software programs I've ever used. And it has a functionality and an interface similar to things like Final Cut Pro or Adobe Audition, which are more expensive and professional programs. And Vegas, my understanding of it, is like for consumers who want that professional interface, that's what it is. But everything that I've thought of that I want to do, Vegas can do. And as your work gets more sophisticated, you'd have to use something like Photoshop to import elements that, you know, maybe there's just some graphics capabilities that Vegas doesn't have. But short answer, Vegas and Audacity, even though I think about upgrading to Adobe stuff, I haven't encountered anything that those programs can't do. The only thing I don't like about Audacity is you can't edit on the fly. So if you're into going back and cutting out ums and ahs and pauses, every time you do a cut in Audacity, you have to stop the recording. What I actually started doing is putting podcasts as WAV files into Vegas and just cutting them as I go and then like pulling the portions I want to keep back into place so you don't have to stop. And I find you can, once you get comfortable with that, you can edit a podcast significantly faster than you can with Audacity. But because I know everything Audacity can do, that's what I still use.
I had left out, you mentioned Photoshop. I think that if you're going to be doing any sort of media production, you're going to want to have some kind of image manipulation program. I think Photoshop is the top of the line thing for that. Again, I didn't pay for it. I got it from torrents. If you're into intellectual property, might want to seek a different, cheaper alternative.
There's Pixlr, which is a web app that does a lot of the stuff Photoshop does.
Awesome. The other thing I would say is if we're putting stuff out on the internet, you probably want a website. I can't endorse WordPress highly enough. I think WordPress is one of the best things that ever happened to the internet. It's the most popular blogging platform in the world. A lot of very large companies, Huffington Post is run on WordPress. So it's an excellent application. And if you're doing podcasting, I used to pay for Liberated Syndication. And I used to pay them a whole bunch of money every month to host my podcast. And they always wanted more money because I wanted to upload high quality audio. And they're like, well, lower it down to 64K. And I'm like, go fuck yourself. It's 2014. I have a hard drive space. So I got a thing called Blueberry, Blueberry, podcasting software for WordPress. It's a free plugin for WordPress, and they'll even give you statistics and stuff like that with it. So those WordPress and Blueberry podcasting, I would say, are very useful things.
There's one I've always used, Podomatic, which is just another, and their statistics are pretty good. I use WordPress too, so there's like a plugin for WordPress for Google Analytics. So you can, I mean, you just, if you're unfamiliar, it's just a code that you put on any page that you want to track. Podomatic, as your show gets more popular, it costs more. Initially, I think you can get on it for free and just, you know, see how, like, going through the flow of uploading a show works. Because I use WordPress, then I just take the output from Podomatic and put it into Blueberry that he mentioned. And it plays right out of WordPress like that. But Podomatic is also worth checking out. But it, as you get more listeners, it does become more expensive.
The guy in the black shirt.
We can't forget SoundCloud either, for hosting.
You all have black shirts on. It's just a joke. Go ahead. No,
this is more like a navy blue. Okay. So just real quick to add on like the podcast hosting services, I put all of my archives up on SoundCloud, and their unlimited package is like $15 a month, and it's absolutely amazing. I also put everything on Spreaker, and as long as you do not have a profane show, then you can then submit to iHeartRadio.
You're out,
and
Cantwell.
Yeah, Cantwell's out. I think Brett might be, because I've heard a lot of F-bombs in some of his shows. But if they accept you onto iHeartRadio, they wind up giving you a free upgrade to the broadcaster thing. So it's basically unlimited and, you know, is free. So that aside, my studio, except for my mic stands, is in this bag. And it pretty much cost me less than $100. And the sound quality is amazing. And I know that three of you plus Mark, you kind of have a studio, although it's more Ian's than yours, but like I know that, you know, you can spend as much or as little as you want on a decent sounding studio. So for Stephanie and Brett and Chris primarily, can you talk about some of the hardware that you have and like what the cost of the hardwares were?
Yeah, for sure. I started out with some Audio Technica AT2020 microphones that were about $79 each or something, less than $100. I got two of those microphones to do a podcast with a guest, a mixer, plugged the mics into the mixer, and then ran a USB out of the mixer to my computer, which had Audacity, and that was how I did my podcast. I also, for Skype guests, I had a hardware setup where I had another computer running Skype, And that was going into the mixer through just a line out of that computer, like a speaker line out. Hardware solutions tend to be better for recording Skype calls. You get higher audio quality than with like call recorder. But I've since upgraded my setup because I do voice acting now for a living, so I really had to have a better microphone. The AT2020 worked great for podcasting, but for professional quality voiceover, I got a RE20 microphone, Electro Voice, which is basically the broadcast standard. It's got a really nice sweet spot for the microphone. It filters out background noises. It's got a built-in pop filter, and the audio quality is impeccable. It's basically just broadcast quality, professional voiceover quality, and it's actually nicer because it doesn't pick up as much background noise as my previous mics did, so it's a little bit forgiving if there's a hum of a computer fan or something else in the room. To reduce noise, you can do it in a room has blankets hung up. It's a cheap hack for getting better sound quality so the sound doesn't echo off the walls. There are lots of other things you could do. Some people record onto a Bluetooth connected mic into a computer in a different room, so you don't even have to have the computer in the same room as you. The RE20 mic was about, I think I got it for like $400 or $500. It's an investment, but it's the broadcast standard. The RE20 mics were less than $80. They've gone down in price since. Got some boom arms with the XLR cables that go into the mixing board. Those were, you know, $30, $50, something like that. Mixer, under $200. So, you know, you're looking at $500 to $1,000 to get a really professional quality setup, plus some blankets hanging on the walls. I actually have a page on my voiceover website. It's smvoice.info, and I've got a blog post and a page that shows all the equipment I have in my studio and has links to it on Amazon. So instead of that spreadsheet that I sent to Brett, it's now a blog. It's now been turned into a blog post. So if you want to see every piece of equipment that I use in my home studio, smvoice.info, and then just click on the studio link.
Gentlemen?
So I have a couple of Samson microphones. Like, they were marketed as karaoke microphones that I got for $10 on eBay. And I originally had a Nady, N-A-D-Y, four-channel mixer that I got for under $25. But I named some garbage podcast that for a reason, because it's fucking crap. And so I've tried to upgrade the equipment over time. I now have a Yamaha mixer. I can't recall the model number of it, but it's like a 8-channel thing with compressors and all different sorts of dials on it. And I got that for like $100 on eBay. And the boom arms that clamp onto the desk. I mean, I don't think I spent more than $1,000 on everything that I put together for some garbage podcast, and that includes all the garbage that I've thrown out because I thought it was a great deal.
If you want to do it, if you want to go no holds barred, go to Stephanie's at smvoice.info, is that right? And look at her audio section. If you want to do it the cheap way, go to creamyradioaudio.com, and both of them will produce.
Michael Dean copied a lot of that content from me. He asked my permission, but I'm just saying. By the way, one more thing about this. The Blue Yeti is a really popular microphone for podcasting, as is the Blue Snowball. The Snowball's $50. The Yeti is $150. They both have really good sound quality on the cheap. And if you get a pop filter, which is basically like a little circle with like stocking kind of fishnet material like strung in between this little circle, it'll decrease your plosives, which are P sounds basically and B sounds, so it'll even out the quality of your audio. And there are some tricks you can do in Audacity to level out the volume, but we won't get into those.
I was going to say Audacity has some helpful things. I mean, I still have a little bit of like white noise in the background of my audio. Audacity cuts it right out. My YouTube videos of the podcast they live stream to YouTube through Google Hangouts, and they actually have a noise reduction built into that takes it out for you.
Let me get this last question in, guys. Joel, would you step up to the mic?
Yes, during your career, so to speak, has there ever been a time when the content you've created, the stuff that you weren't really interested in, ended up taking off way more than the stuff you really wanted to do? And if so, what did you do at that point? Did you say, no, screw the market, I'm going to stick with what I love doing? Or did you sort of respond to the market demand?
I think that one thing that people respond to is enthusiasm. So, like, what are you bringing to what you're producing?
And I think if it feels obligatory, like, oh, I have to do this show about this thing, if it's not something that you're interested in, I see this a lot with people who are trying to keep up with current events just for relevance, and they don't really have much interesting to say. And I kind of just, I abandoned that. I tried that for a while, but I just didn't have any enthusiasm to bring to that. I didn't care about Common Core, you know? I mean, I've talked about it a little bit, but... You know, I don't have much interesting to say about it. It's like the same crap they've been trying for 50 years, you know, or at least since the 70s, as far as, centralizing school. But, so I think most importantly, it's the enthusiasm you bring that's what people respond to.
Anybody else have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I'll add to that. I was, my first media production was YouTube videos. And when I started writing, I didn't think that would be, my YouTube videos weren't terribly popular, and I didn't think that my writing would be as popular as my YouTube videos. And it turned out that people were more interested in the writing than the YouTube videos, so I responded to market demand and kept on writing. As it turns out, that was like easier, right? Because when I was making YouTube videos, I was writing out scripts for my YouTube videos, and then reading them. And I'm like, oh, now I don't even have to read the fucking thing. They'll do it for me.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. This is the media panel. Christopher Cantwell, Brett Fanat, Dr. Stephanie Murphy, Garrett Ian. Thank you very much. Cantwell, get off the stage. What? It's 2:45. All right, brother.
Okay. Hey, on that, can we go back to the... I got a prop.
Okay.
This was just as another suggestion. Somebody asked a question a couple back about hardware, and I wanted to mention that we also, I think, Dale and Jay replicated a lot of the same equipment that Stephanie was using. I'm assuming that's where that stuff, the ideas for that stuff came from, right? Right, so we were able to get more out of that equipment because Dale got a compressor, so it really tightened up the sound in what was originally an echoey room. And we, or Dale really, as time went by, upgrading the studio we had in Manchester, which there's probably a few shows that use that, I only use it occasionally, went from, you can just hear the improvements in quality over the years without really changing the equipment, even adding things like acoustic foam. Makes a huge difference. This device is something I would recommend if you're mobile. It's there's one right. I should have turned mine on. That's why I bought it for times like this. This is a Zoom H4 Handy recorder. There's also a Zoom H6 Handy recorder. It has two XLR inputs, so it actually works as a mixer, but the internal or the built-in mics that it has right at the top here are good enough to just basically set it on a table and do an interview. I mean,
this at an NPR. If you like the sound quality that you hear on National Public Radio, this many of their infield correspondents will use these same devices.
This is $200. There's a 6 that's $400.
That's the one.
There's an H1 that's $100.
Now, right.
And they're the same except for the outputs. Is that right?
The 4 has two XLRs, and that's just the input versus USB that you would use for the microphones. The Zoom H6 has 4, but you can also buy an adapter for it, which I think is like cheap, $60, that you can add two more XLR inputs to it. So this has been really handy to have for just bringing places and being able to interview. It was really hard to do quality interviews before without, having microphones plugged into a computer or having a more sophisticated setup. So the Zoom is great.
The only thing is getting it through the TSA. It kind of looks like a taser.
Robert.
I would just like to say, Creamy Radio Audio, Michael Deans, if you're going to teach yourself how to podcast, that's a lifesaver and a half because it has all the information you didn't know. Now, all you guys do different in delivery media. You guys all have a different niche. You all have a different genre of what you're doing. What do you think that in delivery media is a niche or a format or a genre that isn't being done that you would like to see done?
Does anybody like to give up their trade secrets?
I think I'd be interested in seeing more animation or cartoons. I think they can have mass appeal. They just need to be done properly and professionally. South Park, I'd say it's not a libertarian show per se, but it has so much mass appeal across cultures, and I'd say like often has a sort of social or political message, but still doesn't come across as a political show. So I think like using simpler forms of media, things that are more basic that just appeal to everybody. Cartoons are nice and colorful, and they're artistic. So I'd probably like to see more of that.
I'll jump in. I think meme production at this point, for whatever reason, the internet is focusing on Facebook, and you know, those good memes, they really get a lot of views. That in and of itself, it was produced as itself as outreach. It's going to be very successful. What you'll see currently is you know, Students for Liberty or y'all grabbing stuff from all over. They actually cut Free Talk Live's logo off one time and stuck theirs on. I mean, like they're, you know, there's this ravenous you know, cannibalism that's going on in the Liberty movement for memes. And what if somebody just created a Facebook page with sort of basic Liberty stuff and then you know, memed it out and put you know, linking back to themselves, I think that you'd get a lot of views that way.
I think if anything, I would like to see more fiction. You know, I think a lot of us are talking about current events, we're talking about philosophy and ideas and stuff like that. I think if there's anything missing, it's fiction. I think that people are very interested in made-up stories, but if we can have made-up stories that have a you know, a fable, if you will, I think that that would be great.
Thanks.
And I would just second what Garrett said about animation. I think you can get away with a lot more, you know, and there's a better chance of maybe penetrating the mainstream with some of that. I'd like to see people take my niche more seriously as well. Just by the way, it's not an accident that 99.9% of people are statists.
One more thing, yeah. I would recommend is a daily show produced by Liberty folks. What many of us do is we produce a lot of content because it's easier to produce basically live to tape. Everybody here knows that there's a rabbit hole that goes into trying to remove every and and that's just the start of it. Putting things together in different orders and the editing process is, I think it's for every 10 hours of content, you're supposed to do every 1 hour of content, you're supposed to do 10 hours of editing is like some kind of rule of thumb out in Hollywood, I don't know. But if there was a 30-minute produced daily show for the Liberty world, I think that that could possibly get distribution. Obviously, you're going to have to be funny, and it's hard to find writers, and you know, there's a reason the daily show is popular. But it's interesting that it's the number one news organization in America is a comedy show.
I actually think they're all being done pretty well. I mean, there's so many Liberty shows out there and so many kind of crossover shows. I mean, I was just thinking, you know, fitness, relationships, and you know, film, news, every single kind of thing that you could admit, money, financial stuff. Like, there's just so many Liberty media out there, and they still exist. So the market is saying that, yeah, we want to consume this content. So I think it's almost saturated, honestly.
Does anybody else want to talk before I call David up again?
I was going to ask if
right into the mic.
Everyone says they're a Liberty, you know, person or a Liberty podcast or, you know, media. What would you say would be a defining characteristic of Liberty media, or maybe a core thing, or like two or three things that would define a Liberty media?
That's all. That's a great question. Cantwell. I think everybody should be able to answer this question, so everybody's gonna.
I mean, I suppose that roughly speaking, it would be a general desire for less government interference in one's life, right? I try to explain to people that government isn't going to solve their problems and that alternatives exist. I suppose that that would be the defining characteristic of libertarian media.
Garrett?
I suppose it may have to do with the intentions of the media producer. But I would say that's not necessarily true either, because there could be something produced that's intended to be anti-liberty and intended to sort of, you know, fit a more authoritarian regimen, but in a sense that it speaks to a more pro-liberty audience, or that people can like will look at it and be able to take it as like something that they learn from, even though it didn't have that intended effect. One thing we haven't really talked about too much with intellectual property is the act of hosting media that is prohibited from being hosted in certain areas, I'd say, is sort of like doing Liberty Media in a sense, but it doesn't need to be something that you created. It doesn't need to be something even pro-liberty necessarily, but just the idea that if like media is being restricted or controlled, sharing it is a pro-liberty media act. I would say it shouldn't really... If the intention is to make people more liberty-minded or think about certain ideas in your program, then I'd say it's Liberty Media. But that may not be the intention of like each program that's produced. Sometimes it could just be for the sake of comedy. Sometimes it could be for the sake of, you know, a good story, whatever.
Yeah, it's so broad. I can't think of three characteristics, but I would say, you know, as long as it showcases ideas that would tend to give people more options, more choices in their lives, more respect for their autonomy, removing them from coercion and involuntary, unchosen obligations and things like that, then it's Liberty Media. That's a super broad definition.
I think example is important. Like being free, personally free, should look enjoyable. You know, sometimes I know I've gotten like hung up on things before or gotten in really negative spaces, and it probably didn't seem that way, like I was having a nice time. So, you know, just to try and be a positive example of like, these are the things that I believe and I'm trying to live this and it's working out well, I think is important. For me personally, I've always chose, you know, trying to be entertaining over thoroughness. Like sometimes a lot of this stuff, especially for new people, it can be a little dry, it could be a little intimidating. And just to remember that you can always send people somewhere else. You can always send people to Mises.org if they want to look further into something. And, you know, with the fact that you need to be continuously engaging in mind, or at least for me personally, to say enough to get their interest up, and then tell them where to go if they want to examine it in more depth.
You know, I think for Free Talk Live, or at least for me on Free Talk Live, what I've come to the conclusion of is this is really simple. As long as it's voluntary, I'm fine with it. As long as you're not forcing people to opt into it, I'm fine with it. You know, I'm just against the punching, the kicking, the hitting, the stealing, the you know, shooting people, dropping bombs on them from remote control airplanes. That's the stuff that I'm not down with, is forcing other people through violence, threats of violence, or theft to get what you want. Ian? Got a question?
Nope. That's. Oh, I mean, if you want to wrap it up now, you're welcome to. Now that all the questions are done,
ladies and gentlemen, it's wrapped up.
Thank you, guys.